Welcome to One in Five, the Melbourne Disability Institute podcast, bringing you the latest in disability research from the University of Melbourne. I'm Tessa DeVries. In this series, we'll be looking at how research can tackle some of the biggest issues facing people with disability and their families. Join us as we talk to a range of people about new research findings, possible solutions, and policy ideas. This is part two of an episode about disability and the law. In part one, we talked about the law, supported decision-making, and consumer activity. In this part, we focus on compulsory medical treatment, an area in which supported decision-making, legislation, and disability all collide. First up, we talk to Kath Roper.
I work at the Centre for Psychiatric Nursing.
Hamish McLaughlin.
I'm the managing lawyer of Victoria Legal Aid's Mental Health and Disability Law Program.
And Alyssa Scott.
I work for Independent Mental Health Advocacy.
About the importance of supported decision-making in compulsory medical treatment processes.
Compulsory treatment can entail a number of things. It may be holding someone within an inpatient's ward against their will, maybe keeping them in the seclusion area of the ward against their will. It could also be administering medication by injection, which may require that person to be restrained at the time. So it certainly takes a lot of that person's autonomy and choice away and can be quite a traumatic experience for that individual.
So it's quite widespread compared to what people might think. Happens to about 10,000 people in Victoria each year. And so it's something that not a lot of people come across in their ordinary life, but it is affecting a lot of Victorians every day. What happens is if someone is suspected to be having a mental health episode, someone can get in contact with what's called the CAT team, the Crisis and Assessment Team, and they might come to assess someone in the community, or otherwise someone might be come to the attention of the police. In either of those cases, the person may have what's called an assessment order made over them, which means that they'll be then taken into hospital, into a psychiatric ward in a hospital, and assessed by a psychiatrist. And if a psychiatrist is of the view that a set of what are called treatment criteria apply to that person, then they can be placed under a temporary compulsory treatment order, and they can be given mental health treatment against their will. And that order would last for up to 28 days. And then at the end of that 28 days, the mental health tribunal will hold a hearing to assess whether the person should go on an ongoing treatment order, either in the community as a community patient receiving compulsory treatment or as an inpatient in the hospital. These orders can go on for a long time. So an inpatient treatment order can last for up to 6 months. And a community treatment order can last up for 12 months, and they can then be remade on expiry. So some people will be under mental health treatment orders for 20 years. So the thing that brings you into the system would be an urgent situation, but it need not be urgent to keep you in the system.
When Australia signed the Convention on the Rights of Persons with a Disability, their domestic laws had to then change so that they were consistent with the convention. And that meant that our mental health laws that were much more right to health based. So that idea that, you know, your actual human rights to refuse treatment, for example, they don't, you know, on balance don't matter quite as much as your right to be able to access help if you need it. Whereas I think there's been a real switch sort of globally now around rights based mental health, so that, you know, autonomy is given much more weight. And so under the convention, that's very consistent with this idea of people's self-determination and their rights to make their own decisions and the social model of disability, which is basically saying, you know, yes, you might have an impairment, but really a disability is this interaction between, you know, what you're going through and the kinds of ways in which society might be discriminatory, or it might, you know, close doors for you and provide barriers. It's really the Mental Health Act that talks about supported decision making. So there's an expectation that all clinicians, all staff working in mental health services, I'm thinking of hospitals in particular, should be working under a supported decision making framework. So there are some formal aspects to that. There's a scheme called nominated persons, which means that legally someone can nominate whoever they would like to represent their views or speak to what they themselves would want. It isn't about that person saying what they think is in the person's best interest. It's actually about them representing what the person would want. It's like an autonomy tool. So there's the nominated person scheme that is part of the Mental Health Act. There's a scheme where you can get a second opinion. If you're not happy with the psychiatrist's opinion, you can access that. And there are advanced statements as well. So these are ways to try and keep hold of or have a mechanism for a person's autonomous wishes. So the advanced statement might be developed when you're not in hospital, and then it might specify what treatments you would prefer. And it might even say things like, these are the kinds of things that make me feel worse or more frustrated or whatever. I like to pace when I'm upset. Don't freak out. That's just something I need to do to kind of soothe myself or whatever. And that's really helpful, I think, to clinicians because, you know, it puts them in the picture and they don't freak out. And also it's a tool for discussion. So the focus ought to be on what do we need to do to assist this person's decision making, not let's make the decisions for them because we're worried about them, but actually exploring with them.
In the Mental Health Act, yes, there is a legal obligation to undertake supported decision making. So even if someone finds themselves under a compulsory order, their psychiatrist, when treating them, has to first try and obtain their informed consent to treatment. And as part of that, informed consent is defined as including that the person has been given what's called a reasonable opportunity to make their decision. And then reasonable opportunity is also defined as including that the person has been given appropriate support to make the decision. So it is a legal obligation under the Mental Health Act that people are given support so that they can make a decision as far as possible. However, a lot of clinicians probably aren't even aware of that, that that is a legal obligation. And even if they were, there might be a debate about what you would have to do to fulfill that obligation, what the extent of it was. And then also at the end of the day, would there be any consequences for them legally if they don't follow it? Arguably not, which is a shortcoming perhaps in the law.
It is a huge deal to allow treatments that are not benign, that can create like weight gain of kilos in a matter of months on people. You know, 20 years of life is lost to those of us who've, you know, been on these medications. You can not want electroconvulsive therapy and be given that against your will. That can actually happen under the law. So they're not benign, and I think there's such a danger of dehumanisation in the act of doing something against someone's will that we haven't faced as a community. I mean, we let this happen. We actually let hospitals do this stuff. We let a Mental Health Act allow this stuff to happen, but we don't take the responsibility for it as a community.
So a lot of people might not be aware, but in Victoria, you can still be given what's called electroconvulsive treatment, what's sometimes called shock treatment, and you can also be given that compulsorily against your will. But for that to happen, there has to be a special order from the Mental Health Tribunal, and the Mental Health Tribunal can only make an order approving compulsory ECT if they're satisfied that the person lacks capacity to make the decision themselves. And we took a couple of those cases on appeal to the Supreme Court on what's called questions of law. In one of the cases, it was all about when can you decide that someone doesn't have capacity to make their own decisions. And in that judgment, the Supreme Court said that if you haven't given the person all the support that might help them, you can't come to a conclusion that they don't have capacity, which is a really important point and was a really sort of groundbreaking case because of that. The Supreme Court said that VCAT had got the law wrong because they'd required a really high standard of decision making of our client that doesn't apply to everyone in the community. Basically, they said that she didn't have capacity to make her own decision because she hadn't carefully considered all the advantages and disadvantages, which is a really, really stringent standard to place on people. And I think if we think about it, and if your listeners think about it, it's quite rare for us to actually apply that really rigorous pros and cons, weighing everything to decisions, even really important ones like medical decisions. Quite often people will really just go with their gut or listen out for an important piece of information that's important to them, and that will steer their decision making. So to require of someone with mental health issues to undergo this very careful weighing of pros and cons where everyone else in the community doesn't have to do that. If you have cancer, you can decide whether you want to get chemo or not, and people won't interrogate whether you've really weighed up all the pros and cons. And so the judge ruled that requiring that of our client was discriminatory and therefore an error of law. The court said in black and white, you have to give people support before you decide that they lack capacity, which was excellent. But in coming to that decision, the judge wrote a really remarkable judgment with some really outstanding words. And one thing that he said was when he was describing why it's so important for people to be able to make their own decisions wherever possible, and why it's such a grave and serious thing when you take that right away, he described it in words that I thought were really quite wonderful. He said that when people make medical decisions, it's really core to their identity. And he described it that he said that some people make those decisions as if it's to be the next note that will sound in the song of their life, which I thought was a really nice phrase and described it really well, that people, when you're talking about these kind of decisions, it really goes to the core of who you are. And someone might make a decision because that is what they feel will fit with them. And some other note, to continue the judge's metaphor, might be discordant, and having that forced on you and having something forced on you that doesn't fit with your sense of self is really traumatic and really corrosive to your sense of identity.
We're in, you know, we're in a period of time, I guess, which is a sort of a, I see it as being in transition, sort of moving into a role of facilitating people's recovery, their strengths and their decision making. So this idea that, in fact, capacity isn't pass or fail, it's not about a mental test, it is about this legal capacity, it's about citizenship, and it's saying it's relational. So we can actually work with people to increase decision making through our relationships with them, through building on people's strengths, through giving them information that will help in ways that will help them understand, or, you know, their preferred ways of receiving information and thinking and talking and decision making.
I think it's important to have someone independent, especially because of the power dynamics that play out when the treatment order is in place.
That's Alyssa Scott again.
But that said, I think the Mental Health Act came in 2014. The changeover from substituted decision-making to supported decision-making is quite a cultural change and quite a practice change for a lot of the mental health professionals in the field. And that, I think, has been a hard shift for some mental health professionals. There's a need for training there. It's such a large cultural change for so many people that it's not just a case of making sure that you invoke those mechanisms. It's also how you practice and what kind of questions you ask and what kind of assumptions you make when you're meeting with someone.
Independent Mental Health Advocacy, or IMA, is a service supporting people undergoing compulsory treatment. Advocates work with people one-on-one to assist them through the treatment process, focusing on supported decision-making.
I think the IMA model itself is a great example of supported decision-making. Because we sit outside of the mental health system, we're independent and we don't advise people on what to do. So we often sit with people, provide them information about their rights and options, and then work through a decision-making process with them. So we might explore what positives or negatives people have experienced to certain treatments in the past, they have preferences, if they'd like to try something different. And then once we've figured out what their view or preference is, we enact that decision. So we might go and advocate or assist them to self-advocate. We've developed our own supported decision-making workshop package that we're rolling out, but we're not specifically funded to do that. So it's a gap that we've seen that we're attempting to cover. We've also delivered some sessions with the Mental Health and Disability Legal Team at Victoria Legal Aid on rights-based care under the Mental Health Act. So I suppose there's a number of different ways that you'd need to tackle supported decision-making being implemented in entirety. But yeah, funding is lacking in that space.
I think one of the biggest barriers that we see is that these changes were made in 2014. And as Elisa was saying, they are a pretty wholesale change to how people should practice in this area. But it wasn't, as far as we're aware, accompanied by an investment in the resources that would enable clinicians to really do this properly. And so they are expected to operate with the same resources, but have to do this much more intensive, much more time consuming and much better way of practicing. So there's the funding aspect, but there is also like a training, awareness, education aspect that I think is still, we're still kind of getting there. According to the United Nations Committee, there shouldn't be any substituted decision-making, full stop. Australia has taken the view that the Convention doesn't require removing substituted decision-making. And that's a big controversy because I think certainly in practice, if there was no ability to use substituted decision-making, then you would see a rapid uptake of supported decision-making. But while there is that option on the table for clinicians of using substituted decision-making, well, they will take it. So if you remove that ability, then that would really enhance the use of supported decision-making and funding to services as well, so that they weren't so time-pressured with their patients. But so investing more, doing more training, raising more awareness about it would all improve.
I think there are systems failures that mean that supported decision making is harder to implement. There's so much that could be done in the community. I think in many ways the system that we offer is in fact very flawed. You know, so our conceptualisation of what is wrong in people's lives is actually flawed. I mean, because there is no one size fits all, and yet we are acting as if there is.
I think it's such an integral right of a person to be able to have autonomy over their own body and the right to make choices what happens to them in their life. So anything you can do to support someone to make those decisions themselves is just so important.
Thanks for listening to One in Five. We have lots of information and links related to the research in this episode up on our website. Visit disability.unimelb.edu.au. And you can sign up to our mailing list there too. We'd love to hear your thoughts, and we hope you join us next time on One in Five.